Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Alfred Edesk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will join you immediately following the first break of the program today. And today is Thursday, March 31st, 2016, which means tomorrow is April 1st, April Fool's Day, and I'll just have to see if I can pull a fast one on Al tomorrow. I know I got him pretty good last year, so it might be a little more difficult this year, but we will see. So, but it's still March 31st today, and it's Thursday. And gold, you know, it ended a little bit higher today than yesterday. You know, you're going to hear people talk about, well, you know, people are out there bargain hunting, and but I think more to it, it was the U.S. dollar index had dropped to a 5.5 month low today. So, gold today. You know, we had, you know, it's off its high by about, you know, $10. And right now it's up six at $1,231. Silver is up 21 at $1,553. Platinum is up 13 at $980. Palladium, $568. And you have the USDX today down 0.21 at $94.62. Crude oil was down a few little cents, 0.12 at 38.20. And the paper markets today, you know, sort of a mixed bag, so to speak. The Dow was down 31 points, 17,685. The NASDAQ, basically unchanged at 48.69. The S&P down 4 at 2,059. 10-year yield keeps keeps dropping 1.79%. That was down 0.4. So it's interesting because, you know, people go to the 10-year to you know, seeking safety, a safe haven. And so those when those rates drop, that means people are buying, so they're seeking a safe haven. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on in the market that telltale signs that, you know, folks, this is going to unravel. I mean, you know, the markets aren't, you know, there's no rhyme and reason for a lot of these things that are going on. And in rigged markets, this is what you get. All overseas markets were basically down overnight. There's, doesn't look like there's, you know, any emotion that's really driving any of the markets more greed than fear. But all, everyone, traders, investors, they're all waiting for tomorrow's employment report for March from the Labor Department. And they view this as the most important economic report of the month. I view it as the most distorted and lied about economic report of the month. But hey, the key non-payroll farms, I mean, they're expecting to show a rise of just over 200,000 in March. The payroll processor ADP on Wednesday came out and said, yeah, 200,000 in March. So, you know, we still got a ways for the election. So, you know, perhaps later on we'll see some bigger numbers there. But again, you know, numbers are truly distorted in today's world. So depending on that report, markets could be a little bit volatile immediately after the report is released. So tune in, and you know, the pressure on the global stocks, after Janet Yellen's comments on Tuesday, all of the you know, the positive effects, the bullish effects on her comments, you know, they quickly has dissipated. You know, there was an article out of Yahoo Finance. It was written by some analysts, and it's not about the article. It's mainly about the headline, the title. And the trader says you want to listen to Janet Yellen and ignore the fundamentals. Well, here on this program, we talk about the fundamentals. It's the fundamentals that will lead you for huge gains, not losses. If you follow the fundamentals of Janet Yellen, you might get short-term gains if you're lucky. If those Janet Yellen's fundamentals, if you follow her lead, if they don't turn on the dime and get you caught short. And that's what always happens, and that's what's going to happen. The analysts talked about how the market is rigged. We tell you this every day. The market is rigged. It's controlled by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, you know, by government, the Federal Reserve and Wall Street, it's all controlled over the prices in the markets. If that's how you want to invest, those are the fundamentals. It's not the companies. It's not the, you know, the economies of the United States and the world and so forth, the profits. It's what the Federal Reserve will do. It's what Janet Yellen will do. It's what Washington will do. If that's what you want to base your investments on, well, good luck to you. Get them insured. So those who ignore the fundamentals, which are the paper investments, will suffer huge losses. While those who follow true fundamentals like gold and silver, you will enjoy huge gains. And so I came across this. Again, we talk a lot about debt. We talk a lot about bonds. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, how, you know, the bond market is the next bubble to one of the next bubbles to break. And we see signs. I mean, these just aren't signs anymore. These aren't just leaves in the breeze anymore. These are 2x4s heading at you. You know, and you know, so if you want a 2x4 to hit you, well, if you don't, then get some gold. But the volume of defaulted U.S. junk bonds is expected to climb to $90 billion this year. And this is the most since the aftermath of the so-called Great Depression, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, according to Fitch Ratings. Now, $90 billion doesn't really seem like a whole lot, you know, considering we have, you know, when we talk every day on trillions, and you know, a trillion here and a trillion there, numbers sort of get distorted. People have lost a degree of exactly what a billion is. I should actually say people have lost exactly what a million is, what a billion is, and what a trillion is. But there's a lot of distress in the corporate debt market. And, you know, they talk about how this has surprised many people. Really? We talk about this all the time. How can it surprise anyone if you're paying attention? You know, these analysts at these biggest credit rating companies, how can they be surprised? But they have been increasing their forecasts for defaults. And folks, this isn't made, this is a reality. It isn't like the non-payroll farms report that comes out on Friday. Okay? This is reality. This is a check. This is all due to the easy Federal Reserve policies. This is due to, because of the easy Federal Reserve policies that allows investors to pick up riskier U.S. debt. They ignore everything else. And again, people go into riskier investments. And of course, they have these mutual funds. Their financial planners put these in, put their retirements in these accounts. Yeah, you don't have an idea what's in there and how risky it is. Shows a great return on your statements. You know, and the higher the yield and the higher returns that you get on your statements, the riskier your assets, your paper assets are at. I mean, the greater the risk. And so everyone ignores the fact that it is risky when you get these bigger return. So they ignore everything. The increase in size of U.S. high yield bond markets since 2009, 66%. Now you can say, well, I guess there's sort of good news. The default rate is still lower than the highs that we saw in 2009, but that's because the bond market, the U.S. high yield bond market swelled by the 66%. And it equals to about $1.4 trillion. $1.4 trillion. And the scary part of this is no one really knows just how many defaults are going to occur in the next year or two, in the next month or two. And you're going to find this pain coming from all types of, you know, maybe foundations and hedge funds, to mom and pop type investors who bought shares of mutual funds. And again, I mentioned, you know, your financial planners, your retirement accounts in these mutual, you don't know what's in there. I saw examples in this article, investment firms like, Allianz Bernstein and, Loomis Sayles. They have been among the biggest bondholders of the distressed oil rig company, Paragon Offshore. Now, they're reorganizing under Chapter 11. They have about $1 billion of debt. That's $1 billion of debt, and that's all according to Bloomberg. I mean, these are huge numbers. You have other advisors that are holding $1.7 billion of Verso's papers debt. So, again, you know, these defaults are coming. And this leads me to this other article that I came to, and it's about GE. So it's pretty clear that there's a lot of pain that's coming, and the pain that's coming is going to be far worse than what we experienced in 2008 or what you experienced in 2008 if you didn't have gold and silver to weather you through those years. While your paper investments were dropping like a rock, your gold was covering your paper investments. And that's what owning gold and silver is all about. It isn't that it goes to $50,000 an ounce. It isn't that it goes to, you know, $20,000 an ounce. But it's going to be there preserving your purchasing power. So when these investments fall out of the sky, you can pick some up at dirt bottom prices. And that will make you and your family extremely wealthy. But this article is about GE. And I didn't realize that the Federal Reserve, it was through the Frank Dodd program, that the Federal Reserve picked out several of these companies. Basically, they were the too big to fail companies, ones that received bailout funds, as GE was one. I believe they got over like $100 billion in bailout funds during the crisis. It would have collapsed the whole company if they didn't get the bailout company, along with AIG, GM, just to name a few. But they got a sweetheart deal. You know, Jack Welch, you know, the guy responsible who grew GE to the beast that it became, you know, he gets paraded around in financial news programs, you know, like some kind of a billionaire genius. And truly, he used what was available to him. And he became extremely wealthy. And of course, we know what all happened during the 2008 and what happened to these companies. So General Electric formally asked the federal government if they could be released from supervision by the Federal Reserve. So these companies were supposedly put on supervision, looking over their shoulders. These are, you know, $500 million companies, and they have the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government looking over their shoulders to see if they shrunk its massive financial services so it would no longer pose a systemic threat to the financial system. Well, number one, GE shouldn't exist today. If they hadn't got the $100 billion bailout, they wouldn't. So the Federal Reserve came up with a category for business for the too big to fail businesses. They call it SIFI, systemically important financial institution, you know, other words, too big to fail institutions. But GE had to submit to financial supervision. And the point that I'm getting to, because I am running out of time and this 20 minutes go by, it goes by very quickly. There was two factors in GE's decision last year to exit most of its lending businesses. So they filed with this a Financial Stability Oversight Council, and they said it cut its total assets in the financing division by more than half. Now, here's the important part. They eliminated the majority of its U.S. operations. Now, this is just a little over a year ago that they made the decisions. Well, if I remember correctly, the bailouts happened many years ago, not just last year. So what have they been doing since they've been bailed out? And it's only a year ago that they were putting pressure on by the Federal Reserve as their financial arm of the company could put a systemic risk to the financial system. So timing is everything. But in the meantime, they've eliminated the majority of its U.S. operations, and they cut the company's ties to the rest of the financial system that had led to it receiving this designation of a company that could hurt the financial system. Now, GE announced this almost 1 year ago, that it would pivot away from their financial services and sell most of the GE capital. Well, they weren't the only company. The other company was MetLife. They also took it to court to fight this government's determination that the insurance company posed a threat to the financial system. They've been fighting this decision for more than a year, but again, a year ago. And we have to look back to the year to see the changes. And, you know, what has changed in the market conditions in order to force GE to begin selling their lending businesses that were worth some $168 billion, and it was almost half of their company. So they're getting out before it's too late. That's how I view it. GE is the first of the four non-bank companies labeled as a SIFI to formally apply to regulators to drop that status. So there's other companies out there. So again, it seems to me that whatever is coming, things changed in the market conditions to enforce the Federal Reserve to tag these companies and for the companies to do something about it. So I'm asking, are you doing something to protect yourself for changes in market conditions? And these companies don't care. They'll just as soon pull out of the U.S. They'll eliminate the majority of its U.S. operations anytime to protect their profits and to protect them. And I'm just asking, are you doing it? And if you're not, you should. And you should give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Tomorrow we're going to talk about Donald Trump's investments. He made up over 300% since the late 1980s. And if you had gold and silver at that point in time, you could have earned or you could have increased your wealth by 300% also. So I'm going to touch briefly on that tomorrow. So make sure you tune in to us tomorrow. Alfred and James Corbett will be joining you here in just a few minutes. And thank you.
obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett, and I'm not absolutely certain if he is or is not on the line. The producer, he likes to keep me in suspense. James, are you there?
I am.
Good.
Oh, thank.
One of those things, you start the program, you get into the segment, I don't know, you know, is James here or am I on my own? What's happening? He says yes. The producer now says yes, James is here. All right, so thank you, producer, for that. James Corbett is the author of The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, thecorbettreport.com. And you can find great information, articles, and on geopolitics, the global economy. And James is reporting from Japan, where you've lived for, I believe, 11 years now?
12.
12, okay. Whatever brought you to Japan in the first place?
I was young, dumb, carefree, looking for a way to kill a year and make some money while I did it to pay back student loans. So this was just an easy way to do that. So I just Googled. I literally just typed into Google teach English in Asia or something like that. And yep. The first website that came up, I applied. I got the job. They flew me out to Japan and never looked back.
Pretty cool. I mean, I did some traveling when I was a kid. I hitchhiked down into Mexico, up to Alaska, and all the way over to India. Traveled on freighter to India and blah, blah, blah. It was always an idea that we would, you know, I could go apply to teach English someplace, but I don't know that never happened.
The funniest part for me was that I never in my life had any particular interest in Japan, never thought I'd be here at all, never had any affinity, never studied the language, just kind of, you know, Googled it, hopped on a plane, and here I am.
How fluent are you in Japanese?
I can get by. I can certainly make myself understood in day-to-day conversation. I can't, unfortunately, follow news or politics. I don't really have the vocabulary for that. And I was very studying very hard when I first came out here and learning quite a lot. And then I started the website, and juggling a full-time job and the website became too much for me to continue my Japanese studies. But I really should get on that, because my son is probably about to surpass me in terms of fluency.
And he's what, 3?
He's just about 3 years old.
Well, all right. So you have the fluency of a 3-year-old in Japan.
I'll be ahead of him for another couple of years, I think.
All right. I've got an article here that deals with Japan from Ms. Shedlock, and it says Japanese elderly commit crimes hoping to get into prison. Retail spending plunges. About that deflation, there's a number of articles, but the Japanese elderly commit crimes hoping to get into prison. What the article is essentially saying is that the pensions are insufficient to support a lot of people who've retired in Japan, and they can be less than $7,000 a year. And as a result, some Japanese retirees are going ahead and committing crimes to get thrown into prison, where they get 3 hots and a cot, and they actually live better in prison than they do on government pensions. Well, to what extent do you think that story is true?
Well, I certainly can't speak to it from my personal experience. I mean, I don't know anyone who's in that situation, but it wouldn't surprise me if that phenomenon is at least happening, and happening more so than one would imagine it ever happened in the past, as the, you know, the belts get tightened and things do become more difficult for the growing number of pensioners here. The Japanese people have historically been, and quite famously, I think, savers, and generally have quite a bit of cash tucked away, either cash and or Japanese government bonds. But I think we're starting to see the belts getting tightened to the point where we now have people who are retiring who don't have that sort of luxury of having a large nest egg saved up. So I think this is probably not a widespread phenomenon, but at least something that probably is occurring in greater numbers than it ever has before.
Now, is it possible that Japanese, they have one of the longest life expectancies on Earth? They can't afford to support their massive growing population of non-productive retirees.
Oh, absolutely.
So the government
is leaving them
in poverty.
There is definitely, this is part of the demographic crunch that we're seeing. And if you retire at 65 here, you have 20 years on average of life left, or something around that amount, to support yourself. And that's, I mean, it's exceptionally difficult to do, and getting more and more difficult as the economy tightens, and as just there's less and less money to go around. So, yes, I mean, if this is a very real problem for a lot of people. As I say, in generations past, there's been large savings, nest eggs that have been saved up for exactly this, and nice comfy company pensions. But that, and the Japanese pension system itself, one of the largest, I think the largest pension system on Earth. But that is not going to be around forever. And as I say, the belts are already starting to tighten. So this is part of the overall demographic crunch that sees Japan not only the now officially shrinking, the latest census came out showing officially that in the last 5 years, the population has started contracting as more people are dying than being born. And now also, of course, we have the aging population. It's Japan, one of the oldest societies on the planet.
When we talk about the crunch, and more people are dying than being born, is this only a function of young people aren't having children in Japan? Is that what's happening here? In other words, we're not getting enough reproduction, but the number of deaths exceeds, but because the reproduction level is low. Or is the death rate actually increasing in Japan and the life expectancy shortening?
As far as I know, it's not on the end part of that cycle. It's on the beginning part. It is because of the extremely low fertility rate here. I believe the last time I checked, something around 1.4 children per couple, which is definitely below the replacement rate of 2.1, and on the lower end of the spectrum. I don't think it's rock bottom in terms of the developed world, but it's near the bottom, and we're starting to see that playing out now. And add add to that the exceptionally long lifespans here, and that means you have a lot of very old people and not a lot of young people. So I've seen that personally in terms of school closures and dwindling class sizes and that mm-hmm. type of thing, which is starting to play out in the Japanese, certainly in the Japanese countryside, as the population continues its urban shift. And basically you have all of these rural towns and villages just dying out very slowly.
Japan's in a great deal of financial stress. If people who've retired can expect 65, can expect to live another 20 years, there's a significant financial burden in supporting these people, even whether they're getting enough or they're not. Is it too extreme to wonder if Japan is intentionally shortening, ignoring the problems of some of these retirees? Are they simply incapable of addressing the problem, or are they just saying, all right, let them die? We'll keep them under stress. Some of them will die earlier. We won't have to pay as much. We won't have to pay as much money. And part of the reason I say that, Japan has spent over 20 years trying to stimulate the Japanese economy with quantitative easing and ZERP and zero interest rate policy. And what quantitative easing wanted to inject currency into the economy. Why not give some to the retirees and say, go buy yourself
a
decent meal? They're not doing that according to this report, the implications of this report. And is that an oversight or is that intentional?
Well, I think, the point of something like quantitative easing isn't just to inject money into the economy, because that would be inflationary. So we can't just give people money. What they want to do is to try to readjust investment expectations to get people out of just purchasing Japanese government bonds and getting that money into the stock market. And the idea is, well, you get the share prices of these companies up, they'll want to spend more, this will increase wages, and those increased wages will then filter out through into the economy in terms of higher retail spending. Of course, that isn't happening, demonstrably is not happening. We have retail spending down, we have unemployment up, we have real wages declining month after month for two and a half years or something like that here in Japan, with one or two blips on that radar. So there, in every single way, that's failing. But at least that's the overt, what they will say this policy is supposed to be about. So it's not really supposed to be about getting money directly, giving people money directly. It's about trying to filter it through so that this results in more economic productivity in the country.
It's a good theory, but in the end, I think it amounts to, aren't we talking about the trickle-down theory, where we give a bunch of money to people who already have more than they need, and the presumption is that they'll spend it and it will trickle down to the great unwashed?
Essentially,
does that theory work?
It never has, and presumably never will. It's again, it's just a variant of central planning, and central planning is doomed from its very inception. The economic calculation problem, as Mises pointed out, means that central planning is doomed, because a central planner cannot understand and calculate the best and most efficient use of resources. It just cannot happen, because there's the question of individual will, and you cannot know that ahead of time. The only thing that can decide that is a free market. So it is doomed to fail. But if you're going to go the central planning route, you can either go trickle down or trickle up. You could try to give the money to the banks and corporations, or you could try to give it to the people. Either way, it's going to result in exactly what we're seeing, stagnation at best, and actually falling off the cliff at worst, which is what Japan is doing at this point. I mean, it's certainly sliding further and further down at this point, and Abenomics gave a momentary boost to the stock markets here, but has done absolutely nothing in terms of generating economic productivity.
Is there any way to overcome the demographic problem of too many elderly and not enough children?
Well, the government wants to try to start getting people to have children. So there are a number of local governments and municipal governments here that are now trying to implement various plans and schemes for getting people to procreate, including having the city government in some cities sponsoring dating clubs and social activities to try to get people together so they'll have children. And, of course, also subsidizing, children and giving child allowances and that sort of thing. It hasn't had a lot of effect yet, and it doesn't seem like it's going to have much of an effect in terms of just the overall society here. You have more and more young men and women saying that dating and having children is just a waste of their time and resources, and that seems to be culturally ingrained at this point, so I'm not sure any government program is going to counteract that.
Why do they think, I mean, that's a little unusual. I can see where they might say that marriage or reproduction is not on their minds, but you're saying even dating is not particularly on their minds. Now, I don't think that's happening here in the United States. They're big on dating. They may not be big on reproduction and whatever.
Yeah.
How do you explain that in Japan?
Well, I want to be careful not to make too much of these kinds of broad sweeping generalizations, because a lot of the, you know, news, the Western news media picks up on these types of cultural phenomena and try to make a story out of it and sometimes overblow certain things. But there certainly is a culture of entertainment here and people spending a lot of money on frivolous hobbies and following the latest pop band sensation and traveling around to all their concerts and that sort of thing. And that does detract from people's ability to carry on regular, you know, social activities outside of that. And that's the way this is generally portrayed. It's just a bunch of nerds and geeks who would rather spend time, you know, playing video games than dating. And there is an aspect to that here. And I don't think it's purely a Japanese phenomenon, but certainly that is an advanced stage here in Japan. And we see that. I think we see that reflected in a lot of different ways, but probably the best person who foresaw this and articulated this, at least in the Western world, was Neil Postman, who wrote about Entertaining Ourselves to Death, where he said, basically, you know, the Orwellian idea of boots on the face, you know, tyranny is not really the type that will ever win out. There will always be people who resist that. The most effective way will be to placate the population Brave New World style, Aldous Huxley style, with games, entertainment, just distractions to keep people from ever really questioning the structure of society. And I think we're starting to really see that play out in a significant way across the developed world, but perhaps in a leading edge kind of way here in Japan.
Does it threaten the developed world? The undeveloped world is not overly entertained. They're out there making babies as fast as they can. Is the developed world in jeopardy because it's so busy? It's so busy being entertained that it doesn't have time to reproduce.
I mean, that has to be one of the factors. I think that is a factor, and I think there is a kind of cultural, social, psychic, almost in terms of psyche, the people's individual psychology warfare that's being waged on the population and on the idea of a family, starting a family, having and raising a family. Has been effectively not denigrated per se, but certainly removed from its primary central position that it's had in generations past, to the point where Generation X onward these days does not really see having a family as that type of standard course for young people when they get out of college and they get married and they have children. That is not the standard course these days. I think there has been some cultural warfare to institute that. I think we also shouldn't neglect the biological warfare, biochemical warfare that's played on the population that has resulted in a staggering 50% decrease in sperm counts in the Western developed world over the past few decades. And I don't think that's just a random happenstance. I mean, I think there is a type of biological warfare that's played out through these gender-bending, endocrine-disrupting phthalates and other chemicals that have been, I think, deliberately inserted into the food supply and into every aspect of our life, to the point where it is starting to have an effect on our ability to reproduce.
Do you think these adverse effects are just a reflection of indifference, where the people are making money and forget it. We're making money off of it, so if they go, they lose their sperm count, that's their problem. Is the government indifferent to that, or does the government want it?
There's always a profit motive that can be the first order motive for this, but I think we also have to look at the longer term agenda, which has been written about for decades on paper in black and white about this type of biological warfare being waged on the population by big name notable people, and perhaps we can talk about that after the break.
Let's do that. Let's take a break for some commercial announcements, and James and I will be back. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We'll return in a moment. Please stay tuned.
PSA count high? Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 for international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, and we're talking about evidence of genocide that's being seen in Japan, and not just in Japan, perhaps more pronounced there than other places, but throughout the Western world insofar as sperm count has been reduced by 50% over the past couple of decades, indicating that the Western world will be less able to reproduce itself. And like Japan, you're going to see an aging population, which creates a void of sorts that invites, you know, invasion by foreign, less civilized people who can't afford PlayStations or whatever. Is the world going to fall into the hands of the people who can't afford PlayStations, James?
Well, I suppose so. Yeah. No, it's a good question. I think that, again, this phenomenon is taking place on a number of different levels. And as I say, there is a cultural kind of warfare that's being played right now to try to disintegrate the family nucleus that is the binding basis of human civilization. And we've seen that taking place in a number of different ways. But as I say, there's also a biochemical aspect to this. And this is a documented phenomenon. There was a study that was released about 20 years ago that came to a startling conclusion that in the past 50 years, sperm counts in the Western world have halved, going from 113 million sperm per milliliter to 66 million sperm per milliliter, which was, I mean, a pretty startling finding, and but one that shocked the scientific world at the time. Those results have been called into question, and what studies were used and how they were looked at, etc. But there is a decline in sperm counts that is being documented right now, and there are studies up and scientific articles about this. I'm looking at one at livescience.com. Sperm quality and quantity declining, mounting evidence suggests. So I think this is demonstrably related to some of the chemicals that have been worked into our food supply, into our plastic production process. BPA is one that got attention in recent years, bisphenol A, as an endocrine-disrupting, estrogen-mimicking compound that, for example, in certain species of fish in various lakes was turning male fish into female fish. Uh-huh. And these are the same types of hormone disruptors that that do have demonstrable effects on humans, especially fetuses that are developing in the womb. So there's a lot of things to be concerned about there. And as we mentioned before the break, I mean, there can just be a sort of profit motive to this. Well, you know, I mean, it's an efficient way of making this plastic or whatever, so we'll continue to do it and cover up the effects. But as I say, there's a long and documented black and white treatises that have been written about the need to transform the human species from what it is now to one that is more easily controllable in a number of ways, including in terms of its reproductivity. One example of that I'd like to draw your listeners' attention to is a book written by Charles Galton Darwin in 1952. Of course, as you might imagine, that is the grandson of Charles Darwin and also a member of the incestuous tie between the Darwins, the Galtons, and the Wedgwoods. They formed this sort of infolding family tree where cousins married cousins for generation after generation, thinking they were going to create Superman as part of their eugenical attempt at, you know, at messing with nature. It sounds ridiculous, but you have to look into the history of that. But this Charles Galton Darwin wrote this book in 1952 called The Next Million Years. And the founding conceit of this is that it takes a million years for a species to evolve into something different. But if you use technological means, you can get that done in much sooner. And so he actually said in this, for example, attempts at improving the lot of mankind have all hitherto been directed toward improving his conditions, but not his nature. And as soon as the conditions lapse, all is lost. So he went on to say that talking about the different types of technologies that can be used to transform human nature, he said, another type of discovery may be connected with hormones, those internal chemical secretions which so largely regulate the operations of the human body. The artificial use of hormones has already been shown to have profound effects on the behavior of animals, and it seems quite possible that hormones, or perhaps drugs, might have similar effects on man. For example, there might be a drug which, without other harmful effects, removed the urgency of sexual desire, and so reproduced in humanity the status of workers in a beehive. Or there might be another drug that produced a permanent state of contentment in the recipient. After all, alcohol does something like this already, though it has other disadvantages that is only temporary in its effects. A dictator would certainly welcome the compulsory administration of the contentment drug to his subjects. And this, I mean, again, you have to read through these actual statements. They're quite amazing in their sort of forthrightness. And they only reflect things that have been talked about by Aldous Huxley, for example, in a famous speech he gave the year before his death at Berkeley, where he talked about the final revolution, the ultimate revolution, was going to be these types of brain altering technologies that would make people happy with their servitude. Or you read Bertrand Russell's writings on these types of subjects, talking about how in the future a dictator will be able to make the process of revolt against government as unlikely as a revolt of sheep against the practice of eating mutton, was one of his phrases. This has been talked about and aimed at for quite some time, I think, by people in positions of power and the technocrats with the ability to accomplish this. And keep in mind, this was all being written about and talked about 50, 60, 70 years ago. I mean, imagine how much more scientifically accurate and pinpoint that those types of technologies are now.
You know, I was sued by the Attorney General of Texas for $25,000 a day back in 2006. I was the last of seven defendants in a case that started in 2001. And I stopped them with a freedom of religion defense that really nobody had ever seen before. And what the basis of it was, I was fiduciary for a trust that was leasing some tables and equipment to a corporation that was manufacturing colloidal silver, which is an inexpensive antibiotic. And the government wanted to stop the sale of colloidal silver, so they came after husband and wife and their corporation. They were the biggest manufacturers of colloidal silver in the country. They started with them in 2001. Later, they added another man, his corporation, his trust, and I volunteered to be fiduciary for his trust, and they added me. Much to my surprise, I became a defendant. Again, each defendant was faced with fines of $25,000 per day. I read the relevant drug laws. They said in the case, they said the key to this case is deciding whether colloidal silver is a drug as defined by such and such, but was a Title 21, Section 321 of the United States Code. Read the relevant law, and it included the phrase, man or other animals. And I saw it the first time, and I thought, these people are crazy. They don't know how to write. They're saying man is an animal. And then they said it a second time in the same federal definition. This is definition of drugs, definition of food, definition of medical devices are all based on the presumption that mankind are animals. Now, there's an organization called GenocideWatch.org or .net. I don't recall, but Genocide Watch. They've got a document up there that's the 10 stages of genocide. And the fourth stage is declaring your adversary, your enemy, whatever, to be nothing but insects, vermin, or animals. If we've, the research I did, the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, 1906 was the first to declare that the people would describe the drugs and define food and define drugs in terms of man or other animals. According to GenocideWatch.org, by reducing us to the status of animals, that is an act of genocide. Right? And it's been on the books for 100 years before I read the law and understood what it meant. And they dropped the case. And that was after investing 6 years and nearly $500,000 in pretrial hearings and investigations. The Attorney General of Texas simply dropped the case rather than face a freedom of religion defense on it. The point to all of this is that genocide is not as far removed from daily life as a lot of people suppose. And there are people in positions of power that are threatening our lives. And what is their reason? James, I mean, if we can see evidence of this, what is their reason? And I don't think it's just profit. Nobody's doing this just to make a fast buck. Well, I won't say nobody, but it doesn't seem to be an adequate explanation.
No, I agree totally. I think there are people at lower levels of this system who implement it for profit reasons, but I think the plan itself is not formulated simply for profit. Again, this has to be ultimately about power and control. And there is the saying that if people are allow themselves to be treated as cattle, then they are cattle for the slaughter.
Yep.
And that is the type of mentality we've seen amongst ruling elite throughout human history. So it should not be surprising. And in fact, you heard in that quote from Charles Galton Darwin, the idea of humans being workers in a beehive. The beehive has been one of those symbols that ruling elite have used for thousands of years to try to represent the perfect society where you have all of these workers toiling as slaves for their queen. And that's the type of society they want to try to find a way to organize. So I think that's ultimately what it is about. It is about the ultimate power and control to completely control other human beings and to make them into slave workers of some sort, whether that, you know, I mean, to in some sense take away their humanity. And I think that's ultimately what a lot of these issues really does come down to at the end of the day, the war against our own humanity, what it means to be a human being with all of the rights, privileges, and responsibilities attendant thereon. And if they can get people in their own mind to mentally enslave themselves by by denigrating their own humanity, then I think that battle is largely already over.
Yeah, I agree. When you look at it and you begin to catch wind of it, and you begin to sense and say, oh my gosh, if you study it and you look into it, you begin to see this is not a new thing. This is not something that started in the last, 5 years or something like that. This has been going on for generations. And it implies that there is a cadre of people somewhere who are able to maintain an objective for 100 years and not really tell the public about it. And just keep on working at it and working at it and working in ways that are brilliant just by changing how people think about themselves. Not by shooting people or going to war, but by changing the way people perceive themselves. Kind of scary. Maybe more than kind of. Maybe it's very scary. And you have to wonder, what is it they really want? You want control? If you're going to exterminate the Western world, and that's what it really does seem that a lot of this applies more to the Western world than it does to developing nations.
Well, developing nations can be bombed and controlled militarily and occupied in that way. But the developed and Western nations that go along with that, they have to be, you know, persuaded to do so, and they have to be convinced that that's important. And then ultimately, the same ideas and technologies and military warfare, all of that ultimately points back at the populations that are using them. That's the real trick to all of this. And we see that quite literally when it comes to the military technology, or the quote unquote military technologies, the MRAPs and all of those devices that are first deployed in Iraq and then are used to police people in the United States. It always turns around inward. And I think it's the same idea of going out to conquer different people around the world because, hey, they're not us. That mentality ultimately comes home to roost. And the ruling oligarchy does not feel that the people that share the same geographical space with them are them just because they live in the same geographical space. And that's, I think, what this ultimately comes down to, a ruling elite versus the rest of humanity.
Do you see that in Japan?
Yes. In fact, it's much more sort of encoded into this society here because you have the same type of imperial conditioning here that existed in the more imperial times. It's still here. There's still a very much top-down organization of society, and it leads to a very calm and peaceful society. I mean, there's a lot less crime here than in a lot of countries, but unfortunately, it's also a country where basically by flipping a switch and rolling out an ad campaign, you can get people to go along with nearly anything.
Well, that's a shame, and it's a challenge we are all facing, although we're not all aware of it. I mean, it's happening around the world to some to greater or lesser degree, and trying to educate people to resist the conditioning that they've been exposed to for centuries, perhaps. It's been building for a century, maybe more. How do you teach people to give up that conditioning? Not easily done. You try to communicate some of these ideas, and people look at you like you've just stepped out of a UFO. You know, you sound like you're talking crazy or whatever.
It's an information war, and that's why I'm here, and I assume that's why you're there, and that's part of what we're doing here.
Yeah. Absolutely. We're going to have to talk more about, well, maybe next week we'll talk more about the difference between 1984 and Brave New World. We'll see if we can get to that. It's always impressed me as a significant point, and maybe it will be one of the topics for next Wednesday night and broadcast on Thursday on our afternoon program. Thank you for being on the program again, James. I always look forward to talking to you. Always enjoy it. I want to thank all of you folks for listening. I'll be back with Melody tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett.
Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day, and pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.